In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. In past shows, we've examined the evidence of revisionist history narratives with renowned author Michael Hoffman and explored the Bargos Islands and potential hollow earth concepts with researcher and ancient map collector Harry Hubbard. It was back in 2015. The libraries of old maps, photographs, and history books offer more clues and timeline vulnerabilities than some may realize. This is a realm deeply explored by David Edward and John Levi. They've co-authored the book titled Evidence of the Old World. Their research in this book focused on the western United States, specifically the San Francisco area. The city's urban landscape, its early survey maps, and unique historic architecture tell a rich story for those willing to decode. Edward and Levi bring a level of scrutiny to this area's timeline from the late 1500s onward that reveals surprising inconsistency departing from the known academic history. Research into the city's construction dates also reveal gaps and near impossibly short lengths of time for a building's completion, considering the economic and social hardships of that time period. This is the type of forensic investigation the two authors bring to the table, making it certain North American history, as presented by the academic institutions, is out of chronological order. Our guest is David Edward, co-author of the recently published book, Evidence of the Old World. He holds advanced degrees in engineering, including a doctorate in engineering, three related degrees, and has an undergraduate in business. David served as a special agent in the U.S. Army in the 1980s and is a veteran of multiple overseas combat tours. Edward is a graduate of the U.S. Army Intelligence School, where he studied advanced human intelligence and battlefield counterintelligence. He's the author of the book End of Reason and Unreasonable. David, welcome to Another News.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on. Evidence of the Old World was a fascinating read and not what I expected. I thought you were going to dive into speculative Tartarian connections and etheric technology constructed within the old buildings, which is fine, but instead, your approach was primarily evidence-based. Would you please tell listeners what started you on the path to research this type of North American history dating back a few hundred years ago?
Sure. And, you know, you mentioned it's not just my book. I wrote it with a guy named John Levi. And he's actually been doing this research for at least 5 years. He's got 5 years worth of YouTube videos out there. So the way I kind of explain it to people is John has kind of done the field work. He's done a lot of boots on the ground, and he spent literally 5 years documenting basically what we could call inconsistencies or contradictions within relatively recent history. It's not ancient history like when we talk about Atlantis or ancient Egypt or any of that stuff. There is a much more near-term and more recent flair to it. So I had been interested in Atlantis. I've written a book on Atlantis, and I came across John's videos, and they intrigued me. In fact, I thought he was onto something, so I reached out to him. And the way I kind of explained it is he's kind of like Socrates, which would make me Plato, I guess. So he's the one with the big ideas, and he's kind of trying to figure stuff out and all of that. And then my job is to try and figure out what he's found and document it, which is what we're doing in these books. And Evidence of the Old World is the first of, we have six books planned. We didn't want to jump right into the stuff that he talked about when you opened, just because that's like the end of the story. What we wanted to do was see if that's where the evidence led us. If we took a rigorous scientific approach to looking at history and analyzing it with fresh eyes, right? So we call out in the book that while we use what they call secondary sources to provide context, a secondary source would be like our book. Our book is a secondary source. It's, we've gone out and we've looked at primary sources, so people that actually saw it, or you know, the notes of and journals from real people that existed, or these actual, you know, buildings, and there's a lot of physical evidence left. Those are primary sources. And then books like ours are secondary sources. So what we decided to do is, let's not try and figure out what the corporate media has said, or the corporate academics, we can get into that. But we just went with fresh eyes. And we started with no assumptions. I guess our only assumption would be not to bring any assumptions in. And then we did the analysis ourselves, which is the book that you hold there.
Yes, and that book title is Evidence of the Old World. And in it, you begin with the naming of San Francisco. What brought suspicion to the naming of this area?
Well, you know, maps, a lot of our research starts with maps. And the other part of our research obviously goes to text, books that they, you know, as they call them. Now, when you enter a book, the author, the person who prepared the book, it knows where you're going to enter. You start at the beginning and you read through it in a linear fashion, and pretty soon you're at the end. So when it's written to introduce ideas and subjects in that in a linear order. The problem with a map is, depending on where you are, you know, you can enter it from anywhere. So we just decided to pick, we wanted to go somewhere where there wasn't a lot of tangential existing history. So we were looking for one of the newer cities, the newer regions. California fit that bill. Theoretically, it was the city of San Francisco was only founded in like 1850. There's history before that, but it doesn't go back much more than about 75 years in the area with explorers and stuff. So we wanted to start somewhere. We were looking at these maps, and we realized we were looking at maps from the 1500s, but they show San Francisco on the western coast of the North American continent. And when we did the history, we're like, wait a second, that doesn't feel right. So that was where we entered. And then we pulled that one little tiny thread, and as you see, the whole story pretty much comes tumbling down by just pulling on that one little thread.
Right. The official academic historic narrative of the founding of San Francisco had been dismantled here, which I've actually not seen anything like this in terms of research. And you do go to the East Coast as well and explore the Roanoke Island. And the title of that chapter is Mystery of Roanoke. And I think some listeners may be familiar with this unfortunate event. And for quick clarification, this is the island off the coast of present-day North Carolina. And I noticed also, going there on Google Maps, that there's an annual summer musical called The Lost Colony of Roanoke playing at that island's Performing Arts Center. In the late 1500s, John White led the expedition to Roanoke. You noted his cartography of the area. Please tell listeners more about the significance of your research here.
Yeah, what we wanted to do, the earliest map we could find the labels S. Francisco or San Francisco on, we found both, was in the 1500s, the mid to late 1500s. Remember, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, so we're not that far removed from what we're told from a history standpoint of the discovery of the New World, in air quotes. So when we found that anomaly, we wanted to start looking around to see what was going on from a cartography standpoint in the Americas. And the Lost Colony of Roanoke, it coincides almost, you know, to the year, if not to the day, with some of the stuff that we found on those San Francisco maps. So we started looking at John White's map, and it has 1587 map. The story of Roanoke is well known. We don't get into the mythology of the story, but to sum it up very quickly, one of the first English settlements on the East Coast was on Roanoke Island. We're told they had a tough time. They either did or didn't get along with the natives that were there, and they struggled. John White, who was the mayor of the colony, or the governor of the colony, I think they called it, went back for provisions in 1584, and he returned in 1587, and everyone was gone, including his daughter and his daughter's daughter, so his grandkid, and the whole thing was gone. And there's a whole mystery around where did they go. They found weird writings, Krakatoa, all kinds of stuff like that. When he returned, he mapped the area, and it's a pretty decent map. What we did, because we're looking for anomalies, is we looked at the map, and we realized that there were some areas on it that were patched. So they had covered over whatever he had originally drawn, which was interesting. We were suspicious because of what we were finding on these other maps. So we did a little more research, and it turns out in 2012, the University of North Carolina, actually in 2008, the University of North Carolina got interested in the map he had created, the John White map. And through a series of, you know, everything turned slowly in academia, it took them a couple of years. They finally asked the British Museum, which is where the map was housed, to look under the patch, because they wanted to know what was under this patch. And if you look at it, we have a picture of it in the book, that the river that island goes inland from, there's basically a fork 30 miles in, and there's a big pseudo-peninsula that kind of sticks out, and that's where the patch was. So they looked under the patch, and what they found was a star fort, which in 1587 does not align to any possible, even any derivative of any narrative we have. Some of the speculation is, well, maybe it was an English fort and they wanted to hide its location from the Spanish, or some, you get stuff like that, which is ridiculous, because if this was a top secret fort location, it's out in the open on the map, but B, you don't draw it on the map and put a thin little patch over it. You destroy the map, right? Because that's how I have a military background. You don't, with military secrets, you don't leave them on and do some kind of lame cover up. So basically, there is no explanation for why that would have been covered up. Some people say, well, maybe he made a mistake. But when you look at the quality of the map, and it is of a very high quality. In fact, it we note later when you get into Lewis and Clark and some of the other explorers that were told were very prominent, John White's map is 100 times better in its detail and its presentation. Yet they hid a star fort, which then brought us to the question of, well, what's a star fort, and why would someone be hiding out on a 1587 map of Virginia in North America?
Do you know about when that patch was put over that map?
It's original. So it would be part of him producing the map and turning it over to his government, because part of his charter, part of how he got funding to go back with the supplies, was he promised to provide some cartography, which was very, very valuable, right? Because at this point, the British are very interested in North America, and they have concerns of empire. So this is as much a military-funded expedition as anything. And the patch was put on pretty much, as far as we can tell, within the time period the map was created, whether that means the day he drew it or 2 years later, or, you know, but still within the time period of its creation. So it's an original patch.
And I haven't done this, David, but have you looked on Google Earth of this area, and is there a remnant of a star fort?
Of course I looked on Google Earth. We in fact, some of this is coming out. We're working on our second book now, which is called Maps of the Old World. And we wanted to introduce this concept because this led us to star forts, which takes us back to San Francisco, which is kind of the focus of the evidence book. But when you go look now, it's wonderful what's there. If you watch any of John's videos, every now and then he'll rant on his hatred of golf courses, because he believes that between golf courses and parks, those are some of the tools and mechanisms that are used to obfuscate some of this history that we're trying to dig up. So sure enough, if you go look, anyone can do this, go find the John White map, see what's under the patch, find it on Google Earth. What's there today is a golf course. It's devastating. It's devastating. And then you go research the history of the golf course, and you find that it was hastily put together, and it was funded right around the time the University of North Carolina got interested in this area. Matter of fact, they have an excavation there that's still going on right now, but it's several, not miles, but it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of yards to the north of where this star fort was. So what they're digging for, who knows? And they're not digging, you know, they're finding remnants of settlements, but the star fort got bulldozed the instant we discovered that it existed, 400 years after the fact.
This is a great example. I didn't plan on asking anything further from the star fort being on the map currently, but here you have an example in real time of how interesting this area of research can be. Going further into your book, David, your approach in researching star forts has many layers of critical analysis to it. For example, you examine the labor pool available at the time, the construction material needed, and the practicality of high-quality workmanship in the Starfort design, a design that wasn't necessarily made for strategic defense. Would you please tell listeners some of what you're finding in the unique Starfort analysis you've done?
Sure. And Jeff, direct me back if I head off on a tangent. There's a lot to that question that I can unpack. Basically, a Starfort is an idea that has been around since, let's say, the Renaissance or the Middle Ages, and the current narrative tells us that they were an evolution of a defensive fortification strategy designed specifically to deal with the advent of cannons, which, you know, at some point cannons were new and they were became very portable. And you get to Napoleon and the War of 1812, but even hundreds of years before that, the idea is that these star forts are the remnants of defenses that were built during the time when they were trying to figure out how to defend against cannons. In the U.S., what we find, we have the War of 1812, which we all learned about in school. That was a war with the British. And the story is that after that war, the U.S. decided that it was woefully lacking in coastal defenses. So they devised what they call the third-tier starfort system. And the idea is that these third-tier forts would be technological marvels that they would put around strategic locations around the shore and into bays and things like that. And they would be built to such a quality that they could defend against naval bombardments, and not just defend, but also prevent enemy tactics. You know, so prevent, for example, Mobile Bay in Alabama. They built a star fort on the point of Mobile Bay to defend the bay. So those types of things. And we see these forts all over the place. There's Fort Jefferson, which is in the Dry Tortugas, which is in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, which is quite amazing. Fort Morgan is a fort that I've studied and been to many times. It's in, I think technically it's in Alabama. It's right on the border between Florida and Alabama. So I became a brick mason expert. I've owned a construction company, so I have that background. But there is something, I call it a straight bond, but it's also maybe known as a stretcher bond. When you stack bricks, when we go look at a brick wall, we're all totally used to seeing it. We don't know what we're seeing, but it's called 2:1. So you look at a brick wall, and you know, you see all the bricks are kind of laid sideways, and then the next row up, they're staggered half so that none of the seams line up. And that's the simplest way of building a brick wall. It turns out there's many other ways to build a brick wall. Some of them get very decorative. So you have what they call English bonds, and then you have other types of Flemish bonds. And a Flemish bond is an incredibly intricate way of building a brick wall because every brick is turned the other way. So you wind up with this incredible weave. And you do that, the Flemish bond, which takes about twice as long as the straight bond, but it delivers like three times the structural integrity in the walls, even though it uses more bricks and, you know, takes more time. And you have to be an expert mason to do it. However, so all these star forts are built using this Flemish bond. However, when you actually roll back the engineering, I have an engineering degree, the walls are 7 feet thick in these star forts. So the problem is you lose all of the structural benefit of the Flemish bond once the wall gets more than about 3 feet thick, because in the end, 7 foot of brick is 7 foot of brick, no matter how it's stacked. Yet all of these star forts exhibit, you know, you mentioned expert masonry. It's beyond expert masonry. It's artisan masonry. Yet we're told, for example, Fort Morgan, we're told it was built in 3 years. It is 36 million cubic yards of brick material. And it was built by 200 leased slaves that included women and children. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. On top of that, we did an analysis that I hadn't seen anyone do. It was very easy to do, which is how effective were these forts? So if the U.S. government put all these resources into it and all these incredible timelines and they were built so quickly and they have such high engineering qualities, did they work? And what you discover is no. By and large, the first time these forts see any kind of combat, they fall. Fort Morgan is my example because that's the one I physically can go to. There's the great quote, you know, damn torpedoes full speed ahead. That was a naval battle outside of Fort Morgan. And Fort Morgan fell every time it was attacked. It changed hands. The British had it. The Confederate forces had it and the Union forces had it because it was not a viable defense, even though the history of it is that it was engineered to be this near impenetrable defensive structure. So we found all that, and then we started looking at San Francisco because we're like, well, why would someone build a star fort out there? Because technically they tell us these third-tier systems, there's two star forts they tell us that are out there. There's Alcatraz Island, which when you actually look at it, it's not... It doesn't have the qualities of this type of masonry. And then you have Fort Point, which is what we decided to look at. And Fort Point is the only third-tier system that was built on the West Coast. It was built, we're told, in the 1850s. And this has the same engineering qualities and everything, but these are all grossly out of place. So then we started looking at, well, okay, Fort Point, these things, if Fort Morgan in Alabama took 36 million cubic yards, not feet, but cubic yards of material... When we look at San Francisco in 1850, we're told Fort Point is 9 million bricks. And, you know, we're giving you a construction period for it. We just started basically putting the project plans, and we did material acquisition, and we looked at, you know, the labor pool that will be required, and we just laid all that out. And then when you overlay that to the environment of San Francisco in the 1850s, I don't even think we reach a conclusion. We just present it, and it's so obvious to the reader that the conclusion is kind of foregone, which is you get to the end and you're like, well, that's not right. That couldn't happen that way.
Yeah, I really enjoy that part of your book, how step by step approximate what it would cost and how much labor and material would be needed to construct something as intricate as Fort Point. But ultimately here... You're mentioning that some of these star forts, the fundamental structure of these star forts may not be specifically for defense. That might not be the primary role. I've seen on very old maps in Europe from the 1400s of star fort structures, and these are drawings, with villages inside and large buildings inside. So I wonder if that was also what we're looking at, something similar to... back in the medieval times when it was just a protective mechanism and maybe some etheric elements to it also, but essentially a protective mechanism for a small community.
We don't get into that in this book. We probably will start to unravel some of that. With the evidence book, and you're noting this, you said it wasn't exactly what you expect. I think that's pretty much consistently the feedback we get, immediately followed by... also what you said, which is it's 100 times better because there is no speculation in it. It's just facts and analysis, and we present everything. We walk through it very, very slowly. So whatever they were, I don't know, European star forts, I don't know those narratives. What we wanted to do is we wanted to focus on narratives where we had a concise history that we could analyze without a lot of unknowns. And in North America, the third generation forts were built because of our military deficiencies during the War of 1812. That's the story. You go to Harvard University history department and you ask them that question, that's what they'll tell you. So all we did was we took that narrative, we applied it to the other history we're given, and then we looked at how effective they were in actual military exercises, or not exercises, actual military combat, actual battles. And it doesn't line up. Either our military leaders were idiots, honestly, and they wasted years and incredible resources to build worthless forts, or something else is going on. And we don't speculate. All we do in this book, this first book, is we lay the foundation that says, here's the history we're given, here's a critical analysis of it for real. It doesn't work. We don't know why. I mean, we have our own ideas, and we're developing this in these other books, but we don't present any of that in this book because we felt like we had to take the time, do the work to present the case, present the evidence that this was a legitimate field of study, that we're not kooks, you know, we're not out here just being contrarians and not agreeing with, in air quotes, you know, mainstream whatevers. We wanted to prove that there was something to look at. And we do. And the book proves it. People cannot like it. We can dispute that we reverse engineered our material acquisition appropriately. Like, for example, the Midwinter Fair and some of the other things in San Francisco. We do a wattage analysis of the electrical usage needed and the plumbing based upon what we can see in pictures. People can argue we did that wrong. But even if we're off by orders of magnitude, it still proves the narrative we're given for history is, as we say in the book, at best, and it's most generous, it's not in the order that we're given.
I really appreciated that, and it helps others that are interested in this material. It gives them a little more support. So you've both done something very good here. Kind of an out-of-context question here about Starfort design, and I don't know if you have looked into this, and that is fine if you have not, but I was then looking at the Pentagon building, and I'm wondering, was that some type of Starfort at some time, and they built on that?
Well, look, the entire history of Washington, D.C. is open for this type of analysis. The Pentagon itself, while it certainly emulates many of the things we find in these other star forts, the truth of the matter is it doesn't have many of the things we look for. All that brick masonry I talked about, and the Flemish bond and those types of things, it doesn't have. Also, it's of a size that we don't see anywhere else. So my instinct is it's a joke in plain sight. The people that built it knew what they were emulating, but I don't believe that it was secretly built 400 or 500 years ago, and then we retrofit its purpose. I don't think it fits that model. There is a danger when you do this. I mean, I've started looking at bricks, and the problem I have now is I have to catch myself because I start to think every brick wall I see in the world is a conspiracy theory, and I have to force myself to, you know, be rational and think, no, go look at it. You know, it's not, doesn't have these. They're very specific characteristics that we look for in the masonry and all the other stuff. And the Pentagon doesn't have it, and most of the brick buildings in the world don't have it, but the few that do fit a very, very particular pattern that we're identifying. And once you see it, it becomes really difficult to unsee it.
Well, speaking of bricks here, your investigation, this is you and John Levi, your investigation into the amount of bricks needed to rebuild from the many fires and earthquakes suggests that San Francisco would need about 200,000 bricks a day from 1852 to 1861. Would you please talk about what you found here to be out of sequence against the academic historic narrative?
Well, the big thing with that is all of the brick-making companies that are historically captured in the various histories that we have start to show up in the late 1860s and early 1870s. So the infrastructure and capacity to create the number of bricks we see in buildings attributed to being built before 1862 or whatever, the capacity to build those doesn't show up for a decade or a decade and a half till after we see them used. So that right there is a problem. When you do hit the 1870s and 1880s, and we have historical records that purport to tell us about these companies and their brick production, they were producing about twice that as San Francisco continued to build into the latter half of the 1800s and into the early 1900s. So our number of 200,000 is half of what the historical records said they were using 20 years later. The problem is, what we did is we cataloged all the buildings, including Fort Point, and we cataloged the environment, which we can talk about here in a second. And what we don't find in any historical record is the ability to actually produce these bricks. So then we said, okay, well, let's pretend like they did produce them. What do those logistics look like? So we started to look at the clay, how you get clay, what you use for mortar, what the different logistics are of farming the clay, transporting the clay, the weight of it, what the tonnage capacity was of a horse and cart, which is what we're dealing with, which is about a ton, or I think 1 or 2 tons, something like that. And you start to put it all together, then you start to overlay that to the photographic evidence we do have. I mean, we have a lot of pictures of San Francisco in the 1850s, and you look at the infrastructure that was available, the roads, the crossroads, the grid of the city, and you start to plot where the buildings were built and where the brick would have had to come from. You would have had 1,700 cart trips an hour or something like that across all parts of the city, and the city infrastructure simply couldn't have supported that. Yet we can still go look at some of these buildings, and we can still put our hands on the bricks that were somehow produced to build them, but the timing of it just doesn't make any sense.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's pretty clear to listeners here. Something is out of sequence.
Yep.
David, will you please talk about the 1849 map making that would have known the city's precise alignment and layout of an extensive land reclamation project occurring many centuries later.
Yeah, so what you're talking about, there's an 1849, they call them surveys. So it's just like if you buy a new house, right? You have to have someone come in and survey where the lot lines are. And everything we do now starts with a survey. What we found was a government-sponsored survey from 1849 of San Francisco. And this survey itself presents all kinds of problems, but it's absolutely a real survey. We found copies of it in newspaper articles and all over the place. And we put a copy, put an image of it in the book. And what we find in the survey is that in relatively short order, in something like 2 or 3 months, someone was able to go in 1849. This is before the city boomed. The gold had just been discovered weeks, if not months, before the survey started. They basically, to a degree that today is still within inches of where streets and buildings are, they mapped out the entire southern segment of San Francisco along Market Street, both sides, into a grid, with, like I said, within inches. And they managed to map land that was hundreds of feet underwater, but today is above water because of reclamation projects, as you mentioned, and has buildings on it and streets. In fact, they have whole streets running under the water with the same name that it still has today. You can see the shoreline on the map, so we just point this out. And we point out where Market Street is, and we point out, here's the survey, here's the underwater portions, hundreds of feet underwater. How did they do that in 1849? And then how did they magically know that what the name of the street was going to be 150 years later? So it's crazy. And then we have, I don't know if there's any of your questions, but we have the second survey we found, a Navy survey, where they came in 1850. 59, I think, 1857. They did a very scientific survey. It shows all the same things, but it also shows as high as 89-foot sand dunes on Market Street, but with the roads running under them, and roads and buildings running under them as they still run today. And for people that say they were forward-thinking or they knew they were going to clear that or whatever, an 89-foot sand dune, that's a 9-story building. You don't imagine your way through a perfectly straight Market Street underneath an 89-foot sand dune, especially on a military survey that is meant to depict what is there, not what's going to be there 100 years from now. So so none of it makes any sense. So it's all pointing to the fact that the sequence we're given is not in the order that it happened.
Are you getting close, maybe from people who begin reading your book and have answers, or others paying attention and find out about your work? Are you getting close to fitting in some missing puzzle pieces on things like this specifically, the 1849 map and the sand dune map?
I would say yes. We're certainly not. So our plan, we're going to go through each of the pieces, and we're being very methodical because, as I mentioned, John's been doing this in these videos for 5 years. He's proven the case, you have to watch 5 years of videos to kind of get it. So we want to streamline it, but we also do want to be methodical because when we do start to propose solutions and motivations, we know we'll be attacked. I mean, we're already attacked for this book. If you go read, there's some very negative things that get said, which is amazing to me. But so we want it to stand on a strong foundation where we can say things like, okay, well, hold on. If you don't agree with that, let's unravel these 92 things we found that prove and get us to this point. The other thing we're doing, we've got a website called oldworld.cloud. I encourage people to go there. It's completely free. And the community of people have been uploading all these images. So we have tens of thousands of images of the old world that we're even still going through. So we have a central repository where we're trying to collect these things. What I think we're doing, and what I think our ultimate contribution is going to be, is we are looking through the fringe of these historical documents like this. We're finding the contradictions and inconsistencies. And I think when we're done, what we're going to do is we're going to have a catalog of all the information that we're missing, along with some assumptions around why we're missing it. And I think when anyone sees that and they understand the baseline that what we're looking at is real, we're not kooks, we're not just making stuff up, I think there will be an answer But some of that work is still in front of us. So we have our own ideas and suspicions, but we're going to wait till we have that index laid out there. And then I think what we propose will make a lot more sense.
David, could you give that site out one more time, please?
It's oldworld.cloud.
David, your investigation has shown that under proper scrutiny, a single photograph or map or building can be a catalyst to reevaluating the official historic narrative. Would you please talk about the 1856 photograph of San Francisco showing a rather desolate foreground of the city area and a completed Fort Point in the distance?
Yeah, this was a fun one. We've got lots of photographs like this. Easy is not the right word, but once you understand what the timeline is supposed to be, looking at these pictures, you find anomalies all over the place. We found one. Yeah, so the construction of Fort Point was all through the 1850s, and it's supposed to complete in like 1862 or 1863, where it becomes a military fort. During that time, we're told, 9 million bricks, they're importing Chinese granite, there's massive labor, they have to flatten the point that it's on, they lay all the granite down, concrete work, all kinds of work's going on. We found a picture from 1856, so this is when they should have just been finishing the foundation and starting to stage the materials to build the fort. Instead, what we see on Fort Point is a completed structure. And what's interesting, and I didn't put this in the book, or maybe I did put this in the book, but it's kind of the thing I harp on, is there is no activity around it whatsoever. There are no boats providing, any kind of, there's no cranes, there's no people, there's no roads. And the thing I point out is there's no flag. So when a fort becomes a military fort, one of the things that militaries do, especially in 1856, is you put your flag on it. So none of that is there. And as you mentioned, the foreground is baffling because we have things like this survey from this 1849 survey. We have all kinds of pictures of San Francisco in the 1850s, we're told. Yet this particular one shows a completed Fort Point. Foreground is nothing but sand dunes. So again, completely out of place, right? If the picture was misdated, we would expect to see Fort Point, and then we would expect to see the other structures that the historical narrative and other photos tell us were there. Instead, we don't see that. We see rolling sand dunes and just a few sparse buildings. And then in the very distance, we see a completed Fort Point with absolutely no activity around it whatsoever. So we get lots of, I don't know why, for some reason, anger is an emotion that gets invoked. So the counter argument is there were so many boats going back and forth to San Francisco that used granite and bricks and other things as ballast, which means they put it in the bottom of the boat to keep it from tipping over, that there was just so many of those that they didn't have to make any of the bricks. They just took all those out of the boats, although why would they take those out and if they're ballasts? And they used those. So let's look at it. So how many ships are we talking about? And then we do the math in the book. So what tonnage and class of ship would have this many bricks in it, for ballast that they would then be removed and used to build things? Because this is 70 years before the Panama Canal, 60 years before the Panama Canal. So what, they're all coming around Cape Horn and they're weathering the storm with the ballast, and then they're giving up their ballast rocks. The other thing that we'll tend to get is someone will just do a very cursory Google search and they'll find a picture and they think shows something, and they'll send it like, see, they're scaffolding, so you're wrong. And so they're very lightweight. They don't go deep. One of the things we did with this book, this book is made of gold. It's the heaviest book you're ever going to carry because we've gotten in front of, I believe, all of those. So please take the chapter where we outline the tonnage and the amount of Chinese granite and the brick and the acquisition logistics of moving that the weights around and the locations of things, and ask them if ballast affect the story at all.
This is part of the learning experience and unlearning experience, and looking at books that are in special collections that may not be accurate, and whether that's intentional or not, it's something to just bear in mind.
Well, first off, it's a secondary source, and we're a secondary source. So everything, even our book, is people interpreting something else. There's a lot of coordinated history going on. getting frustrated or angry, I totally understand and I'm sympathetic to that being the first emotion, but kind of push through that, because this is a, think of all the things we can learn, is I think the right way to look at this. And then ask yourself, well, look when the book came out, because the closer in time the book is to these events, the more interesting the book might be. The farther away it is, the more it could be a redoing of the history. And then the second thing is, accept that maybe the book is correct, but it's just in the wrong, it's talking, it doesn't know the sequence of things, which is all we propose to this. We don't claim San Francisco's not there, you know, or it was something else or aliens built or any of that. We just think the sequence is wrong. So it could be the book is very accurate, but its dates are wrong, and it's not the fault of the author of the book, because they were probably relying on the authors before them and before them. But somewhere in here, somewhere, for some reason, things got out of whack. You know, we're not even proposing we know why yet, although by the time we're done with this, we're going to at least present what we think plausible reasons for why are.
What I do like is how you have explained something called a distraction ploy, but it's a methodical distraction ploy, which means it likely wasn't an accident that it took a lot of time and consideration to set up, specifically around the building and rebuilding of San Francisco.
Well, there's two things. Yeah, first off, we've discovered broadly, and this will become apparent throughout the books, but we have the template that was used. We're discovering many of the key terms and the keywords, including dates and construction timelines, the number of people built. So there was absolutely a template that was overlaid to a lot of this history. Now, and the distraction ploy. So what the distraction ploy is, and we fell for this originally. I fell for it. And by the way, we invented the term distraction ploy. That's a unique contribution that we put in this book. So when I first started looking at these maps, and I first saw S. Francisco and then San Francisco hundreds of years, you know, before we're told the name was christened to the place, the first thing I started to do was try and align that inconsistency to what I believed were the chronological sequence of agreed upon historical events, right? So Columbus discovered America in 1492, the Spanish were sailing along the California coast and whenever, and all of that. And that's a distraction ploy, because what you do is you wind up spending time on these little tiny, it's a classic, you're moving the deck chairs around while the Titanic sinks. It doesn't matter where the deck chairs are. And by the end of this book, we've given ourselves permission to say, you know what? We're going to find all this stuff and we're going to analyze it ourselves. And we're not going to worry about as much the order that we're told it happened in. If we're told it happened in 1642 versus 1442 or 1942 or whatever, we're not going to worry about that as much to get started, because it's all distractions. You wind up in rabbit holes and you feel very proud of yourself because you're able to move three pieces around. It looks like it lines up. And now you've kind of conformed to the broader historical narrative. So what we say is be careful of stuff like that. Even what we just talked about, the ballast, using bricks as ballast in boats. Well, that's a distraction ploy, because they actually did, but it's irrelevant. But we could spend all of our time analyzing that and arguing about it, but doesn't change the overall problem we're up against, which is that in the end, not much of the sequence of events we have for North American history is wrong.
And this is toward the end of the book here, David. You have chapters addressing the world's fairs in the 1800s. For example, the Crystal Palace, 1851 in London. The Exposition Universelle, 1867, Paris. Centennial Exposition, 1876, Philadelphia. The Chicago World's Fair, 1893, the location for the first Ferris wheel. The California Midwinter International Exposition in San Francisco, 1894. Why are the world's fairs an important focal point to enrich our understanding of the historic narrative?
Well, the world's fairs represent something that's really interesting, and I think even I don't fully understand yet. Generally speaking, it seems like these fairs show up and produce architecture that is inconsistent with the region the fair is held in, But then elements of the architecture remain, but it provides a narrative, maybe a distraction ploy, that is meant to explain away all possible anomalies of a region. So, for example, if we were to go look at Chicago, that's the one you mentioned, 1893. There's the Centennial in 1876 in Philadelphia, and there's a slew of these things. Because the fair is a stake in the ground in the chronology of the local history, any anomaly that you find that you can still go look at, building, streets, layouts, whatever, can simply be attributed to the fair. But they all contain dodgy narratives, just like we went over with Fort Point and with the Star Forts and all those things. So since the book pretty much centers on San Francisco, we head to lots of other places because we try and provide context. There was a fair in San Francisco. I didn't even know about this until we wrote the book. John had to tell me about it. It was in 1894, which is a year after the Chicago Fair, and it was called the San Francisco Midwinter Fair. And just like San Francisco itself, it provided an opportunity because it's not a very well-studied fair compared to all these other ones. And it has such a ridiculous narrative that it was easier to analyze and critique the narrative. The narrative of this fair basically is that in the summer of 1893, like August, something like that, some guy that owned the newspaper in San Francisco had been to the Chicago Fair and just thought it was the bee's knees and the greatest thing ever. And it was imperative, and the only way San Francisco could survive and turn into a cosmopolitan city would be to host its own fair, which they coordinated. They called it the Midwinter Fair, and it was held from January to May 1894. So, okay, fine. We all accept that. You can go read that story anywhere. Somebody started saying, wait, hold on. Okay, August 93... September 94, it's only like 4 months. It turns out it's like 151 days or something like that is the time. And we have pictures where they claim that they have the kickoff event and then they immediately start clearing and scraping and grading the land and they build all these things. And you look at the pictures and it's hopeless. I even say that in the book. It's just, there's no way. But they claim from 4 months, they went from a forested area in what is now Golden Gate Park. In 4 months, they went from forest, to buildings on scale and as majestic as you see in any picture you see at the Chicago Fair or anywhere else. So that was when we said, you know what, let's really dig into it. And that was when we looked at everything. We looked at the electricity, because remember, this is during the electrical wars, and very famously, I think Tesla lit the Chicago Fair. You know, we're still dealing with all of that. We don't have widespread electricity at this point. And even just producing iron and bricks, you know, the whole thing. And then we said, okay, let's take everything we've learned and let's now figure the logistics of the fair out. And what you find very quickly is not only could they have not cleared the land in 4 months and graded it, but it's near impossible to have built. I think there's like five buildings of hundreds of thousands of square feet that look like castles. They have electricity. They built an Eiffel Tower. This is before Eiffel Tower was 1888. So this, but they built a 1/3 replica of what was to be the Eiffel Tower, which is all lit up with electricity and light bulbs, and everything is lit. The mechanics building has electricity everywhere. So we just said, well, okay, well, how would you power that? Well, it's coal. Okay, well, so how many light bulbs did you need? How much wiring did you need? Because the other thing that's interesting is all the electricity in the main thoroughfare of the fair, it's all underground. There's no wires. There are electrical wires on the outskirts, but not in the middle. And then you have plumbing. So we just looked at the plumbing because you have massive fountains. They built like a mile square lake or something. They built a waterfall up a hill and all this stuff. And we just basically say, okay, here's what it would have taken. And then by the end of that chapter, you read it, you can tell me, but I think you're like, okay, well, no way that happened. I think it would have taken 1,100 train cars of coal a day to light the thing. And we can see it lit. So it's there. But we don't see anywhere where there's any coal smoke. Matter of fact, the two smokestacks that theoretically would have been for the coal never have smoke coming out of them. Instead, we see like compressed steam coming out the back of it, which is interesting. But yes, and then okay, let's say they actually did get that coal. Well, in San Francisco of 1894, Where would it have come from? How much would it have cost to get it? And it turns out it's like $10 million worth of coal, but it would have cost $30 million to transport it from the coal mines. So, you know, again, and we're told the whole thing cost $1.1 million. So, yeah, so we took a little simple one and we did the analysis. And I think what comes out is, like I've said before, something's off. They didn't build it in 4 months, and it certainly isn't the timeline that we're given for how the fair came to be.
If I'm not mistaken, I think in some of those photographs of the fair and behind that building, those two smokestacks weren't even there.
Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. When you start to dig into the electrical component, so okay, well, would have been the power source would have been coal. So we said, well, okay, let's assume it's mid-grade coal, which gave us a price, so we could calculate the price. We translated everything to megajoules, and we looked at the energy transfer of coal, its percentage of efficiency. And then we looked at the lighting, and of course, none of that makes any sense. The smokestacks we talked about are never billowing smoke. But then what we find are these things that look like either batteries or I think more like capacitors that are wheeled around and have a physical wired connection into some of the other buildings and attractions and things that we can see have electricity with no other means of electricity. So either all the electrical was put underground, which when you try and project that into the timeline is infeasible. It's not near, it's impossible. Then on top of that, we see electricity in places with these odd looking booths or things with wires running from them. And then we see electricity with no other means of electricity. So there's all kinds of visual crazy anomalies like that. And that was one that we pointed out.
Oh, it's incredible. And this is likely to be direct current, I'm guessing.
Well, Edison was at this fair, and we're in the AC-DC wars, right? Direct current, alternating current wars. Thomas Edison, we're told, was a proponent of direct current. So we used direct current in our analysis. Alternating current can go farther, but it doesn't have to go farther because we see an energy production facility, a power facility, within hundreds of feet of all the places electricity is going. So with alternating current, it can go miles, and with direct current, it can go many, many yards, but not miles. But either way, the math is about the same for both. Alternating current, it would be a little more efficient, but doesn't change any of our calculations. But since Thomas Edison was there, he wouldn't have allowed alternating current. He was a direct current guy. So with him there, with his company presenting, we believe it would have been direct current.
Well, David Edward, you and John Levi have assembled an important critical analysis template for many other researchers to move forward with a more discerning eye and further question the presented archived historic documentation. As more people discover the old world and piece together timelines, evidence of potential resets are being revealed, but being aware of these larger contexts can also lend a calming perspective to the chaos of the current period we're in. Would you tell listeners, please, how they might find out more about your work, order your book, or participate in your research work?
If you go to that website I mentioned, oldworld.cloud, I believe we have links to everything from there. But that's a good place to go. You can find the book on Amazon, Evidence of the Old World, John Levi's website, which I think is johnlevichannel.com. Or the best place to start with John's videos, because that's a really good way to walk into this space. The only thing I tell people is plan on watching. They're between 15 minutes and half an hour. You got to watch. He says three. I think you got to watch around five or six of them before you kind of get what he's talking about. And the other thing I mentioned to people is don't get frustrated or mad like your friend, because this space is very difficult to walk into and there's no easy place to start. So you just kind of have to start, keep an open mind. And at some point, as you see all the different pieces and you learn all the different elements of the theory, at some point something will click. It'll make sense. It's like, what do they say? Calculus is only hard if you're not doing it, right? So doing the mathematical equation to explain how someone throws a ball and someone catches it is very difficult, but throwing a ball and catching a ball is not. And this space is kind of the same. It feels daunting heading into it, but once you get into it, and this book is a great place to start. We made it So it's meant to be an entry point. But even with the book, you got to get through a couple chapters before you really know what we're talking about. But it seems to be. It's very well received, honestly. I'm even a little surprised how well received it is. And we had to walk a line, a balance between making sure we had enough material for the diehard, who is already an expert in this space, and making it also approachable from someone who's brand new to it. And I think we did that. So I think those would be the places to start. Oldworld.cloud, you can see all the pictures, and you start to get a sense of it there, and the other links are all there.
The book is a great starting point for both groups of people. I want to send a thank you to a few listeners and friends. One is Steve White, who has consistently sent me John Levi's videos in the last couple years, which I'm grateful for. A listener in Long Island, Brendan Brigadier, who has been decoding the historic narrative as well. Harry Hubbard and Mark Ahern, both ancient map collectors who teach many people how to collect the right type of books and also research alternate timelines. David, I look forward to the new publication coming out in December and the special feedback you get from the viewers and readers. Thank you very much for being on In Other News.
Sure. We're working hard on maps of the old world right now. It should be around Christmas time, maybe a little after. But yeah, Jeff, very professional. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.